It's a glorious day in America, the most prosperous nation in the world. Workers are working hard and being paid less. Some, like New York Times reporter Stephen Greenhouse, have argued that this is part of a big squeeze. This, of course, is poppycock. Because as we all know, when life gives you lemons, you make lemonade. Work harder, America. We're all counting on you.
All right, so I am here with Stephen Greenhouse, who is the author of The Big Squeeze. Stephen, how are you doing?
I'm fine, Ed. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you here. First off, I wanted to ask you about, well, one major point of your book is that you suggest that workplace abuse, essentially, has emerged because of a shift in American priorities, that the days of Walter Reuther and General Motors fighting for rights is largely over, the low-cost imports in the 1970s and Reagan's air traffic controllers scenario in the 80s, you know, rather 1981, caused where we are at today and what you point out in this book. But it also seems to me that part of the problem may not just necessarily be these shift in priorities, but also the maxim by Eleanor Roosevelt, in which she suggested, of course, that nobody has the right to make you inferior without your consent. So I must ask you about this. Is it really entirely pinnable on business?
Well, I think that there's been a major shift in the way corporations look at their workers. I think back in the 40s and 50s, in the time of the so-called social contract, corporations, for many complicated sociological business reasons, were coming out of a war where we were all pulling together and rich and poor fought together in the war. I think corporations, corporate managers, looked at workers as more, they looked at them more as equals than they do today. Yeah. And there was this formation of this wonderful social contract where the United Auto Workers, the United Steel Workers, and great companies like General Motors, Ford, and U.S. Steel, you know, formed this social contract which pretty much provided job security, provided good wages, provided great health benefits, provided good pensions, created the world's largest and richest middle class. And it was really a golden age in many ways for both American companies and American workers. Now, this has fallen apart for many reasons. And, you know, in the 1970s, the United States, you know, the big corporations really start to feel the pressure from imports. In the 1950s and 60s, American companies, especially manufacturing companies, were largely insulated from foreign competition. You know, who had ever heard of Honda? Who had ever heard of Toyota? Well, that has changed. And, you know, ditto with the steel companies, they felt pressure from foreign steel. Ditto with television manufacturers and radio manufacturers and clothing manufacturers. So there's been much more competitive pressure confronting American businesses.
Yeah.
And there's been a whole series of ramifications from that. They needed to cut costs to compete. As they felt the need to cut costs, they became much more aggressive to get rid of unions. When unions got weaker, there wasn't the counterweight to corporate power. So corporations have been able to push through greater wage freezes, lesser raises. They've been pushed for lesser benefits in many ways. At the same time, to quote, you know, to borrow from Eleanor Roosevelt, you know, when workers had stronger unions, when, you know, management saw workers as more important, more equal, more as assets than they do today, it was, you know, management wasn't even looking so much at workers as inferiors. But I think there's been something that's gone on where, you know, CEOs are feeling lots of pressure from Wall Street to maximize profits.
Yeah.
And they put pressure on their lower level managers, you know, to, you know, push to reduce payroll and minimize payroll. And that creates all sorts of tougher behaviors. And one could say, and to borrow your phrase and Eleanor Roosevelt's phrase, you know, to treat workers as inferiors. You know, job security used to be implicit or almost automatic, and now it's kind of gone out the window. And yeah, that means you treat workers as disposable and maybe as inferior. And some managers will do dastardly things like make employees work off the clock or go into the computer and erase the number of hours they work.
Yeah.
I don't think that happened much 20, 30 years ago.
Well, look at Jennifer Miller, who is this woman who worked at HP for 10 years. She didn't have to work as a temp for that long. She could have easily cut out. She could have gone and demanded more. from the HP managers. So this is why I'm sort of suggesting that I would argue that the workers who have allowed themselves to be placed in these particular conditions are perhaps just as responsible as these businesses who and these corporations who are trying to squeeze out more profits and also trying to combat the influx of low-cost imports.
Again, Ed, you ask a good question. You know, and it's hard to see. Jennifer Miller was a worker at HP, high school graduate, very little college. She worked as she started as a McDonald's, yeah. as a McDonald's worker. She became a McDonald's manager. She got tired of that. Then she got a permanent job at HP. That job was sent overseas, so she was kind of bought out. Then a few months later, she said, "How would you like to return to HP as a temp?" She thought it was going to be a 2-month gig. And as I explained in the book, she was there for 10 years as a temp. Now people, and she said the job was good. You know, it used a lot of advanced skills. She was often treated with respect, but she said the bad thing was she was a temp and didn't get the same benefits as regular workers. She didn't quite get the same respect. So you ask, why didn't she quit?
Well, I mean, also I should point out that she was even barred from the company parties. I mean, this is a key indicator. If, in my view, I would say, well, to hell with this. I'm going to find someone who I can be on staff with.
Right. It wasn't a she, but all temps there were barred from the company. You know, they might create a wonderful new piece of software, create a wonderful printer, and all the regular permanent employees could go to the party and celebrate and go for the 2-day ski holiday to celebrate. But the temps who worked alongside the regular workers. A crazy situation. They couldn't go to the. They weren't invited to the parties. They weren't invited to the 2-day ski holidays to celebrate the. Anyway, so yeah, for someone like Jennifer, there was some eating humble pie there. So question is, why didn't she quit? She said, "For me, Jennifer Miller, mere high school graduate, you know, living in Idaho, that was a terrific job. I was making $30 an hour. I was really using my brain." I was often working alongside terrific people, sort of somewhat treated as an equal, but on the other hand, no. And she said, considering what else was out there, going back to McDonald's, working as a manager, which isn't such a bad job, but she said working at HP even as a temp was better. I mean, her argument was, HP was good in many ways, but there was this one big negative that she was treated as a temp. And she said, her wish was to continue working at this wonderful place, HP, but as a full-fledged regular worker. And she kept hoping that, she would magically be transformed from a temp into a permanent.
But that hope, I mean, after 10 years, it's just a great joke. I mean, first of all, I should point out, Stephen, that I really think you've done a commendable job of reporting in this book in terms of tracking down people. But my question to you is that this idea of hoping, this idea of falling into this pattern of being treated like dirt seems to me just as endemic of this problem as the business mentality. And so I'm wondering how much this guided your book here.
Someone like Jennifer Miller, who's a smart, engaging human being, I'm sure she wouldn't say she was treated like dirt. I think she's has enough self-esteem that, if she really felt she was being treated like dirt, she would quit. But, she was making $30-$35 an hour with overtime, sometimes $80,000-$85,000 a year, which in Idaho ain't bad. And when you're a single mom with a kid, you put up with certain things. So that, making $60,000-$80,000 a year, which is a lot by Idaho standards, so she puts up with being a temp. I wrote about this other worker, light years away, named Julia Ortiz, who arrived here as an illegal immigrant from the Dominican Republic. She's now legal. And she found a job in Brooklyn in the heavily immigrant section of Broadway in a dollar store. And she began there, and she worked 11 hours a day for $35 a day, just a little more than $3 an hour. Now, that's being treated like dirt. I agree. So why didn't she leave? And she was there a whole bunch of years. And she said she was an illegal immigrant. And she was worried that if she looked for other jobs, A, she wouldn't find them, B, that somehow when she was looking, she'd be arrested as an illegal immigrant. Also, she said she was working 6 days a week, 11 hours a day. She had 2 kids to raise. She said she just didn't have the time or energy to look for another job. So my point is, unfortunately, a lot of people feel trapped in their situations. And you see even someone like Julia, who finally got so angry she went to the Labor Department to complain. But a lot of people feel trapped.
Yeah, yeah. And as you point out, they actually don't check if you're an illegal immigrant or not, the New York State Department of Labor.
Right.
But this brings up a very interesting question, because I know you point to this mock memo that was circulated at Chase in response to a merger. It was a mock memo from the executive who sort of suggested, you always think about you. And this also leads me into a question, because I also think in terms of the popularity of a television show like The Office, I think what we're seeing here is that people are willing to laugh at their problem, but they're not willing to do anything about it. They're only willing to resort to this gallows humor as opposed to actually stand up for themselves and to defy, you know, to basically go forward with this Eleanor Roosevelt maxim. And so this question seems to me particularly intriguing. If you're going to pinpoint the problem, well, should you not also look at the look at it from the cause of the worker who is in this predicament and who is... Let's go ahead and just avoid the question of to what degree one is treated like dirt, and let's just point to the fact that workers are often treated like dirt. You also point out to positive examples, but this is the larger question about how workers have managed to get to this particular place, because there was a time 3 or 4 decades ago in which this was not the case.
Well, I just to be clear, Ed, you know, a lot of companies treat their workers well.
Yes.
And I cite some companies that are excellent examples, Patagonia, Costco, a lot of the hotel casinos in Las Vegas. And a lot of companies treat their workers okay. And a lot of them treat them like, you know, we'll use dirt as the four-letter word. Okay. And in my book, I write a lot about the companies that, you know, break the laws, that treat people without dignity, you know, that, you know, don't let workers go to the bathroom and the workers soil in their pants, you know, terrible things. And I think it's important, you know, for America, for Americans to know that this kind of stuff goes on, even at respectable companies with good reputations. They still often very quietly behind the scenes treat their workers like dirt.
Yeah.
And you know, I was just speaking at Columbia Law School earlier today, and one of the big questions is, well, if so many workers are treated so bad, why, you know, isn't there rioting in the streets? Why aren't they all rushing to form unions? Why aren't they crying, you know, revolution, whatever? I mean, you know, it's funny, and, you know, and we just had this New York Times CBS poll saying, you know, 81% of Americans think that the country is going very much on the wrong track.
Yeah.
You know, yet, you know, maybe John McCain's going to be the next president. And he's a very honorable guy, but he's advocating the same policies as George Bush in many ways. Continue in Iraq, continue cutting taxes. So, you know, I think there's a big question. Why, if so many workers are being treated poorly, if, you know, wages are flat, if benefits are getting worse, why aren't workers more up in arms?
Yeah.
And I often think of Bowling Alone, the book. I think of The Pursuit of Loneliness by Philip Slater, that, you know, Americans have just become much more atomized as a people. In the 1930s, when workers were unhappy, they banded together and they were all living, you know, on top of each other in apartment buildings in Brooklyn and Manhattan and Chicago, in San Francisco, and it was easy to band together. For fun, they'd go to union meetings. Now, for fun, you know, you decide which of your 289 channels to look at or which YouTube thing to look at. And you know, I think, and then there are, you know, 8 million different sources of information, whereas in the, say, the 30s and 40s, there are, you know, much fewer sources of information, and people were often on the same, you know, track, and your union was often an important source of information. And I'm not saying unions are the be-all or end-all, but they can often be very helpful, especially for workers like those of today who feel they're being treated like dirt, or, you know, seeing their benefits go down, their health benefits go down the drain, their pension, their good pensions become not so good 401ks.
Okay, let's look at this from another angle. Patagonia, which you just mentioned, of all the pro-worker companies, this one seemed to me one of the most unusual in the sense that it had this fuel-efficient car parking space priority. Workers were allowed to go to the company barefoot and the like. So I put forth the opposite question to you. How much workers' rights are too much? Because this is a bit on the quirky side, and I find this to be very interesting, but I'm wondering if there's a certain kind of cap on how many rights you can give to a worker in order for this question of why the worker puts up with being treated like dirt or possibly being treated too much like anti-dirt. I don't know.
No, you know, it's funny. In researching a book, I decided it's important to have a, you know, I write about a lot of companies that misbehave, that break the law, that treat their workers, you know, like dirt. And I thought it's important to have a chapter showing employers that do it right.
Yeah.
You know, employers to to hold out as models for all of corporate America. And it's kind of, I could choose any company. And, yeah. And I tried choosing some, you know, a staid company like Ernst & Young, the accounting firm, which does a wonderful job in terms of workplace flexibility, you know, work-life balance, you know, work-family issues. That's not as much fun a company as a place like Patagonia. And Patagonia isn't like other places. It's really out there. But it shows what a really good, enlightened, cool company can do. And not many companies are in a position to do, seven out of the 10 things that Patagonia does. But it's a wonderful example. Now, we should talk a little about what some of the cool things that Patagonia does. You know, it has a childcare center right on site. And I wrote about this one guy, Andy Welling, who loves that he can have lunch with his kids.
Yeah.
And he drops off his kids at 9 and picks them up at 5. Another cool thing at Patagonia is that it was founded by a surfer and a climber, Ivan Chouinard, and it was founded in Ventura, 150 yards from the Pacific Ocean. And at lunchtime, many workers go surfing at lunch. And if the surf is running 6 feet hot and glassy, as they say, then they might go surfing for 2-3 hours.
Yeah.
And, many companies wouldn't tolerate that. But at Patagonia, a lot of workers will be trusted to get the work done late at night. And they don't look for FaceTime. They look for performance.
Yeah.
And that's important. And another cool thing at Patagonia is, you walk into their cafeteria. There are, 12 kinds of whole wheat bread. There's, this incredible salad bar with, 83 different vegetables I haven't even begun to hear of. There's Save the Condor posters on the wall. The company gives 40 employees 2-month paid leaves each year to go work for an environmental outfit of their choice. And I interviewed people who went to Costa Rica, to Guatemala, worked in the Yellowstone, to preserve the bison. It's great stuff. And, in ways, Patagonia is, so far out there. Very few companies could do that, but it's good to look at a possible ideal. If other companies began creating environmental fellowships, that would be great. If more companies were encouraged to have childcare centers at right on site, that would be great. Patagonia has 8 weeks paid maternity leave. Mm-hmm. Not just that, 8 weeks paid paternity leave and 8 weeks adoption leave for people who newly adopt. And those are very nice things. And again, it would be great if more companies did that.
It would be great if we did that, because the other nations have a generous idea of parental leave, and this is one of the things that really bugs me. I work with a editor in the UK, and she says, "Oh, I'm going to be gone for a year for parental leave," which is a shock because we only get only a scant few weeks.
One of the amazing things and depressing things I learned in researching the book is the United States is the only advanced industrial nation, and there I'm comparing us with the European nations, Australia, New Zealand, Japan, Korea. We're the only one that does not have paid maternity leave.
Yeah.
We have unpaid maternity leave, but not paid. We're the only, wealthy industrial nation that doesn't, have federal laws requiring a minimum number of holidays. In the European Union, it's required in all the 25, 26 countries, every worker get at least 4 weeks vacation.
Yeah.
Here, you meet many people who in their first year or two of work are only entitled to 1 week vacation, and up to 5 years, maybe only 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And, we Americans work very hard.
Yeah.
Actually, we work, on average, 360 hours more than the typical German. 9 full weeks, full-time weeks a year, more than the typical German. And, industriousness is wonderful, but sometimes, we might work too hard.
Yeah. Well, I also wanted to ask you about this notion of computers being the big brother of the workplace that you bring up. Now, you point out that computers are tracking those employees who are taking these 3-hour lunches in these workplace environments that are not as beneficial or generous as Patagonia. But I should also point out that, the eyes of a really austere human resources manager are essentially the same thing as a computer. So really, what makes this any different from what has gone down before? Those particular managers who we've all encountered at some point, who are there at 1:02 and then tapping their wristwatch over something that is so picayune.
We've all read 1984, and we all are familiar with the idea of Big Brother watching us. But as ubiquitous and ominous as Big Brother was, in many ways, Big Brother couldn't watch us the way computers do. And nowadays, there'll be, overhead cameras in some workplaces looking at things. There'll be, electric eyes when you come into work and leave work that know, when you entered and when you left and when you left for lunch and did you take an hour, 45 minutes for lunch or 3 hours for lunch. And yes, maybe 40 years ago, a very watchful supervisor would know just as well and could probably bust your chops much more than a computer could. But, even now, a watchful boss, supervisor, monitoring computers closely can do that type of thing. But computers can do many types of things that, even the most vigilant, watchful boss of old cannot do. Computers will know whether Jane or Johnny can type 38 words a minute or 70 words a minute. They'll know whether you're busy, emailing your boyfriend or your girlfriend or the person you're having an affair with, or whether you're, writing memos to, customers. They can look that up. One of the unfortunate things that happens is, they could, managers, as I said before, can go into the computer and erase, maybe you've clocked in for 45 hours for the week and they can magically make 5 hours disappear. That's not kind of being Big Brother, but that's, they know right away how many hours you worked and can give you grief if they feel you're putting in for too much overtime. Again, that's something new. I write a lot about call center workers. We all talk to call center workers. They'll call us up to, try to persuade us to get, the latest cable TV stations. We call them up when we're calling L.L. Bean or Eddie Bauer or Land's End. And, some of these call centers treat their workers well. Others treat them like dirt. And, several call center workers I interviewed said, if we're away from the desk for 3 minutes to go to the bathroom, we get grief because the computer knows. And the computer, records us. And then if we stumble at all in the introduction when we make a phone call, we can get fired. We'll get grief from our supervisors who listen in on on calls that are recorded and review them. So, the computer, for creative types like you and me, Ed, in theory, hopefully, we don't feel the watchful eye of the computer as many lower-level service sector workers do. I mean, the person at Burger King and McDonald's.
Yeah.
When they say, may I take your order? There's often a computer, recording them. And there'll be managers maybe monitoring them the day later, listening in on, whether they act fast enough and whether they say the right things and whether they're courteous enough. And, again, it was very hard for the manager of old to be as watchful.
Yeah, that's true. But there is also something to be said about, well, I'm an employee, and if I'm going into a 9-to-5 job, I have an obligation to spend, most of those hours working and not emailing or surfing the web or taking a 3-hour lunch. So I can sort of empathize to some degree with a business who is instilling this particular technology. I mean, it really perhaps is really it's all about taking something to the nth degree in the case of these call centers, for example. But I suspect that I think that it's kind of a fair scenario from a business standpoint to at least be able to track. And that's why I bring up the martinet manager versus the computer, because it seems to me that if they weren't doing it with the martinet manager, they're just doing it with the computer. And yes, it's invasive, and I don't particularly care for that too, but I can kind of see where a business is coming from in instilling these tactics. Are you suggesting that a worker should be slacking off all the time?
No, and I'm not calling for slacking off. I believe in an efficient economy. I believe in a competitive economy. I think that, if the United States is going to remain competitive, if living standards are going to increase, workers have to be productive. And I'm just saying that, too many times managers kind of use unfair techniques and sometimes illegal techniques to squeeze workers. I have this neighbor where I live in Pelham, and I told him, one of the issues I get into in the book is how some managers force employees to work off the clock, sometimes 5-10 hours a week, basically working for free. He says, he owns a company. He says, too often I have to pay workers 5 or 10 hours for do nothing, during those 5 or 10 hours. And I feel bad for him, and that's unfortunate. And workers should be efficient, and managers should be good about getting productivity out of their workers.
Yeah.
But as I said before, Ed, you know, in researching these call centers, it's not just Martinet managers. It's just like, you know, they use computers kind of as a way to psychologically abuse workers. And that sounds crude and coarse, but like, you know, if you're a call center worker and you've just, you know, and you know, the target is to spend no more than 3 minutes on a call, and God forbid you spend 4 minutes and 20 seconds on a call, your Martinet manager might be coming over and glowering at you. And again, the manager wants efficiency, but, you know, the worker, I don't think, is dawdling on the call. The worker's probably trying to do a good job.
Yeah.
You know, if you, you know, for some reason have to go to the bathroom for 3.5 minutes rather than 2.5 minutes, and a manager gets on your case because they could see you're away from the computer, away from answering calls. Again, that's, you know, that's no fun. If you have a long call and want to, you know, stretch for 10 or 20 seconds afterwards, you know, in theory, you're not allowed to. Once you hang up one call, you're required to pick up another call within 3 rings. And just, you know, efficiency is very good, but sometimes computers allow people, to managers, to bang the workers over the head with efficiency.
Yeah, yeah. I hear where you're coming from. I wanted to point out, you have Cooperative Home Care Associates, which is this South Bronx agency in which 2/3 of the workers are on the board of directors. And you point out that if these worker owners are too generous to themselves financially, that this is bad for them as workers and also for the business. And you suggest with this example that, well, here we have an idea of workers being in tune with a business. But I should also point out that even though you show the dark side of independent contractors, could it not also be argued that if one is an independent contractor, however onerous it is with the estimated taxes and all that, that you are just as in control of your ship, that you are just as in control of your resources, that the ultimate incentive, perhaps, in many instances is, well, I've got to pay my rent, I've got to feed my family, and I'm not going to allow myself to be exploited or the business to be compromised because it has to be profitable so that I have a long-term goal. I mean, are these not equally sufficient goals here?
I think it's fine for people who want to be independent contractors. That gives them a lot of freedom. They can make a lot of money. You know, where I don't think it's good is that where someone goes to work for a company and it feels like you're being an employee, you're bossed around like you're an employee, yet the company says you're an independent contractor. When a company tries to force you into that box, it often means it's an easy excuse for them not to pay health benefits for you, not to pay Social Security into the system, not to pay workers' compensation benefits for you, and either you're going to end up paying it or society is going to pick up the burden. You know, if you get injured when you're an independent contractor, you know, maybe the hospital, the emergency room is going to pick that up, you know, the taxpayers are going to pick that up. So, you know, the point I make is that too many companies try to treat people who should be seen as regular employees, they treat them as independent contractors. Now, this home care company in the Bronx, which is a fascinating place, you know, again, one of the model companies I looked at. And when I looked at model companies, it would be very easy to look at a Goldman Sachs or a Google as, well, these are great places to work. You know, they give you massages.
Yeah.
You know, they give you limousines to take you home if you work at night. I didn't write about them because those are really, you know, the ne plus ultra. These are fabulously wealthy, successful companies. I tried.
But you did write about Costco.
The model companies I tried to focus on, and Ernst & Young was an exception. You know, were companies that treat, you know, that hire regular workers like Costco, which is a direct competitor with Walmart, you know, the hotel casinos of Las Vegas, they treat their workers infinitely better than many hotels do. You know, Patagonia is a apparel company, and, you know, some apparel companies treat their workers well, some don't. Now, Cooperative Home Healthcare, you know, they hire workers who, they employ workers who are kind of at the bottom of the barrel. Home healthcare workers, home health aides, they often make just $6, $7, $8 an hour. A lot of them are only given 20 hours a week of work, and, you know, try to support yourself or even a kid or two when all you're given is 20 hours of work in a week. So cooperative home care is very unusual because it's, you know, worker owned, and workers are on the board, and they try to develop
policies that are good for employees, so that, you know, if you've been there at least 2 years, they promise to pay you, to give you at least 30 hours of work a week, and that makes it much easier to support a family than 20 hours. Yeah. And I interviewed this woman who works there. You know, she said at her old place, if she showed up to work late one day because her kid had an asthma attack, sometimes she'd get fired. She'd invariably get bowled out. She said at cooperative home care, they treat you like a human being, like a member of the family, and they try to figure out, well, let's solve this problem. Let's figure out how to get you emergency care or child care if your kid has an asthma attack, and they want to work with you rather than work against you.
I wanted to also ask you about the issue of job security. You point out that it's really no longer part of a relationship that an American has. You alluded to the social contract. I should point out that here you are employed by the New York Times, and the situation really is no different here because there's a hiring freeze in effect, and I know that there was a loss pointed out during the first quarter. And I'm wondering, based off of this, it can't just be Neutron Jack Welch tactics or even CEO salaries that cause these things. It's also sheer economics to a large degree, I would think.
Yes and no, Ed. I mean, I think the New York Times is in many ways a terrific employer. As anyone knows, newspapers are going through a very difficult situation now. Ads are way down. New York Times ad revenues are way down. We lost money, and they're trying to downsize the newsroom by 100 employees from 1,400 to 1,300, 1,300 to 1,200.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, and they're trying to do it without layoffs. You know, Jack Welch, you know, the most influential businessman in the last quarter of the 20th century, he came into GE. He felt the stock price was depressed, and I think one key way he said, I'm going to jack up the stock price, was to lay off not thousands of workers, but tens of thousands of workers. And he really led a sea change in the way that American businesses, American corporate executives saw workers. I think previously, workers were generally seen as assets, as productive assets that added value. And he often saw workers as costs, and that, you know, we should get rid of them because they're too often costly. To some degree, he saw them as assets, but I think he saw them more as costs. And you know, I think it's very different, a Jack Welch, a GE, from how it treats its workers from a place like the New York Times, which very much sees its workers as assets, sees them as very valuable, and kind of wants to ease them out through buyouts, not, you know, saying get lost.
Yeah. But, you know, it could also be argued that, well, if the New York Times is a failed business or is having a problematic business cycle, then, well, this is just the results of economic consequence. I mean, to what degree is job security based off of economic cycles as opposed to something like the Neutron Jack Welch approach to doing business?
In my book, I kind of discuss the history of job security. My colleague Louis Chatel wrote a terrific book called The Disposal of American, where, you know, the whole book is about the end of job security. It's kind of just a chapter in my book, but it's an extremely important topic, Ed. You know, again, you know, with the rise of the social contract after World War II, if you're a white-collar employee in the United States, if you worked at GE or GM or Procter & Gamble, you basically had lifetime job security unless you really screwed up. If you're sleeping with the bosses, if the company was, you know, going bankrupt. And blue-collar workers, they generally had job security. Maybe there'd be a recession, you'd be laid off for 3 months, but then you'd be called back according to seniority. All that went out the window in the 1990s. And part of that is just a change in management psychology. They really saw workers, you know, as increasingly disposable. You know, jobs, you know, it used to be that, you know, you really treated them as assets, you try to hold on to them, and it really changed. You know, we got to learn to get by with as few workers as possible. Yeah. But but that's true for some companies, not for all companies. I think some companies really are more paternalistic than other companies. And I write in the book that, you know, that, you know, Wall Street would look with disdain at companies that saw workers as assets, that showed too much loyalty to workers, because then you were showing too much loyalty to fixed assets. And all we want flexibility, not fixed cost and fixed assets. But, you know, there are companies like the New York Times, the Washington Post, you know, a lot of companies that, you know, still, you know, really treat their workers with respect as assets. And I think they're much more hesitant to, you know, fire people, to let people go, because they're smaller companies, they have extremely talented individuals, and they want to continue attracting great individuals. And if you're seen as a brutal employer, it makes it harder.
Well, again, that's also subject to, again, this issue that we started off with how much dirt is too much dirt, or being treated like dirt. I wanted to also remark upon Melissa Jerkins, this Walmart manager who you describe as sweet, engaging, and she says, you know, in terms of having to cut jobs or to cut hours, rather, to meet Walmart payroll targets, she says, you hated to do it, but by the same token, you can't have a heart. And this, to me, is a really telling idea of what's going on here. And it's almost very much like a soldier's explanation for why he is at Abu Ghraib, you know, doing terrible things to prisoners, because you just get used to it. These people and workers may very well be sweet and engaging, but I guess I want to ask you about this, again, this notion of how this, you know, you alluded to it just in this last answer of companies using psychological force to basically get the worker in this position.
Yeah, I think one of the main themes in my book, I don't want to sound like Al Gore, but, you know, something's really out of balance in the economy and way corporations act. You know, I'm all for corporations making profits. Don't get me wrong. I realize, you know, with Adam Smith and the Invisible Hand, that if corporations are losing money, you know, they're going to close down and people are going to lose jobs. So I realize it's important for corporations to make money. But, you know, when I write about a store manager like Melissa Jerkins, she said there was unrealistic pressures to maximize profits and minimize payroll. She said as a store manager, she was assigned a very low payroll that she had to meet in running her store. And if she exceeded that weekly payroll, you know, her ass would be grass. You know, she could get fired. She could get demoted. And as a store manager, you know, you're making pretty good money. If you know, maybe you're making 50, 60, 70,000 a year, you might stand to get a bonus of like amount. But if you get demoted to become an hourly employee again, you could fall from, you know, 50,000 a year salary, 50,000 a year bonus, 100,000 a year, 120,000 a year. You can go down to $12 an hour, you know, 24,000 a year. So for these managers, it's important to perform well. And a lot of pressure is put on them. And Melissa Jerkins told me that she, you know, and she's a sweet woman, and she's a lovely smile, and she's a great mother, but she's under huge pressure. You know, she wants to climb the ladder at Walmart. She wants to be successful. We all have egos. We all are somewhat insecure about our jobs. And she felt to satisfy the payroll goals, payroll requirements assigned to her, she had to do dastardly things like have some employees work off the clock. Or she said at times to reduce payroll, she would get rid of, you know, $11 or $12 an hour workers who had been there for 10 years just to bring in new workers who get paid $6.50 an hour, just to make. She said, you know, in January after the Christmas rush, she'd lay off people and they should in theory qualify for unemployment insurance at that point. She said, well, we kind of make believe that we fired them for cause, that they had done some egregious thing and therefore did not deserve unemployment insurance. And they tell the State Unemployment Commission, don't give them unemployment. They were fired for, you know, doing dastardly deeds. And she, you know, and she said, if they felt they had too many workers, they might, you know, put certain older workers on the overnight shift unloading trucks. You know, the worst job at the place.
That's the key verb.
Yeah, she felt pressure. You know, she felt she had to do what Walmart wanted, and she eventually soured on Walmart because she felt the terrible victim of sexual discrimination. She was the manager of a store, and she found out that the two assistant managers beneath her were making like $15,000 more a year salary than she was. She realized that the Walmart system wasn't as perfect as she thought it was, and she increasingly became a critic. And now she says, in retrospect, I realized Walmart was like a cult, and I bought into it. I wanted to get ahead. and I did things that I should not have done.
Yeah, but when it's your livelihood at stake, it's more likely to seem a cult than almost anything else. I mean, this is what controls how you get ahead and how you get your American dream and your picket fence and your house and your dogs and your kids and your two cars and all that. I mean, I'm wondering if a lot of this has to do with unrealistic American expectations. I mean, you know, who honestly, outside of an upper middle class bracket, can really afford a house in New York, for goodness sakes, you know?
I think some companies are, you know, are more cultish in building their team, their cadre of managers. And I think Walmart is kind of towards one extreme because it's so big and it has like almost a tried and true way of building its management culture. You know, each morning at every Walmart in the country, people have to, you know, spell out W-A-L, squiggly, M-A-R-T, and dance to it. I mean, this is unusual. And I think, you know, a lot of people who work at Walmart, who become managers at Walmart, grew up in these small towns, you know, where if you made $30,000 a year, that was pretty damn good. And they see, you know, if they climb the ladder at Walmart, they can become a store manager making $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year in base salary, and then at least that much in bonus. And they say, hey, that's the way to grab the golden ring. And a lot of them are willing to climb on others to get there. Yeah. And is it unrealistic expectations? They're pursuing the American dream. And unfortunately, when I say, you know, things are out of balance, you know, too often at too many companies for managers to try to reach for the American dream, they often have to treat their workers badly, maybe break the law, because the demands that, you know, upper management places on lower managers to succeed, to make these unrealistic or very tough payroll goals, get the lower managers to do these unfortunate things.
It's also the carrot, though, because you see this also in law firms where associate attorneys work hundreds of hours, they have billable hours to meet, and with this idea that, hey, maybe one day you might make partner, but there are only so many partner slots. And so really, it does come out to life being out of balance, but I think that there are only so many slots and there are only so many people who can achieve this level of success. So therefore, perhaps it's a matter of reconfiguring what is realistic about living an American life.
Maybe. I mean, law firms, with all due respect, are somewhat different because you work insane hours to try to make partner, and if you make partner at some of these firms, you're going to make $500 million a year. But you're generally not stepping on, you know, if you're a store manager at Walmart, in many ways you might be stepping on cutting corners with the 200 people who work for you. And a law firm, you don't, you know, when you're an associate trying to make partner, you don't have 200 people working for you. But, you know, I know a lot of, you know, I went to law school, I know a lot of people who went to law firms, and the way the unfortunate part plays out is, you know, the associates who want to make partner are stabbing each other in the back or taking credit for things that perhaps they don't deserve to take credit for. But a lot of people, you know, a lot of us law associates are very honorable. They work 90 hours a week and they hope to be recognized. And if anyone suffers, you know, just them. They're not exploiting other people.
Well, I also wanted to ask you about some of the solutions you point to in the end of the book, such as affordable universal health care, as well as raising the minimum wage to half the average wage, which is roughly around $8.60 an hour. But I should point out to you that neither Barack Obama nor Hillary Clinton support such extravagant remedies. I know that Clinton is there for $7.60 and Barack Obama pledged to raise the Illinois minimum wage to $6.50. So I'm wondering if some of these conclusions, although I would tend to agree with them, whether they're actually going to happen, if here are our two front-running Democratic candidates and they don't even support this kind of thing.
That's, again, a fair question. On minimum wage, we just completed nearly a decade where the minimum wage remained unchanged at $5.15 an hour, you know, for nearly 10 years. The longest stretch in American history that the minimum wage remained unchanged. And, you know, a lot of, you know, I remember a year ago, 2 years ago, some fellow reporters would ask me, you know, Steve, what's the minimum wage? And I'd say, it's $5.15 an hour. And they'd say, it can't be. That's insanely low. Who would work for $5.15? Yeah. So when I say that, you know, and I'm not just saying this, a lot of people are saying, you know, we should avoid a situation where the minimum wage gets caught so low. And in some countries, the minimum wage is just indexed to half the average worker's wage. And I would bet, and I could be wrong here, Ed, that if Obama or Hillary were asked, would you support indexing or tying the minimum wage to half the average wage. They may, you know, this is not pie in the sky. You know, in Britain, the minimum, the equivalent minimum wage is probably $10 an hour or more. And you know, I think a lot of people wouldn't say that it's extravagant to pay $8.50 an hour. You know, in terms of other recommendations, you know, I felt a little constrained as a quote neutral objective New York Times reporter about making recommendations. But you know, one of the things I felt in researching and writing the book is, you know, I saw a lot of, you know, unfortunate, sometimes I say bizarre, insane situations where just because some kid's mother or father is laid off from a job, all of a sudden these kids have no health insurance. That just seems manifestly unjust and inefficient and somewhat insane to me. You know, in every other advanced industrialized country in the world, there's universal health insurance, and you know, and the United States doesn't have that. So I think it would be wise and efficient for American business and good for everyone's peace of mind and help kids perform better in school if there are universal health insurance. You know, one point I make is, you know, America from early on decided that every kid should have the right to go to public school for free because they realize how essential a basic education is. And I ask, is basic health coverage any less important than basic education? I don't think so. I mean, health is not a is such an important part of life that it shouldn't be just another good, another commodity that some people can purchase and some can't. Everyone should have it.
Stephen, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Ed.
Okay.